Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Apley. The Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Russia's Sochi has wrapped up, and there has been significant political process in a summit that was attended by more than 2,000 participants. Russia had invited representatives from all countries, the members of the UN Security Council, as well as those representing different strata of the Syrian society. Among the most important achievements, the formation of a committee to discuss the post-war constitution in Syria. Now, in this debate, we'll look at the achievements and shortcomings and why the U.S., its allies, and the absent opposition called this summit as being a failure.
The Syrian National Dialogue Congress held an extraordinary meeting in Russia's Sochi that was attended by more than 2,000 participants. Russia had invited representatives from all countries, the members of the UN Security Council, as well as those representing different strata of the Syrian society. Among the most pressing issues on the agenda were the drafting of the constitution, distribution of power between the center and the regions, as well as strengthening public control over the state apparatus.
This is a Congress of non-representative bodies, but it is being attended by all layers of the Syrian society. This is one of the positive aspects of the Congress.
The Congress was opened by Mohammad Hassan Al-Kala, the forum's elder and the head of Syria's trade union. In his speech, Hassan Al-Kala stressed that the representatives of the Syrian people assembled in Sochi intend to stand united in defense of their country's sovereignty, territorial integrity and independence. He stressed that there is a general unity against those who do not want a better future for Syria. Hassan Al-Kala also denounced foreign interference, saying plots to incite unrest and divide Syrians must be stopped.
We have gathered here in order to say strongly, hands off Syria. The sons and daughters of our country, they alone have the right to determine its future.
When Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov took to the podium to deliver his speech, the hall was filled with applause and shouts in Russian and Arabic. There were words both in support and against the Russian role in resolving the Syrian crisis. The forum that lasted more than 9 hours largely discussed ways to resolve the conflict.
And I will be indicating as soon as possible, because Syria cannot wait, how I intend to proceed on my mandated task under Resolution 2254, which means in practice setting in Geneva schedule and process for constitutional drafting. This way a constitutional committee can really and concretely be established and begin to work. That's what you want, I know.
Following the summit, a statement was adopted with an emphasis on the basic principles of the future state structure in Syria, such as respect for its sovereignty, territorial integrity and independence. It also calls for ensuring the rights of all ethnic groups and ensuring a political process that will not leave anyone behind and that will allow the Syrians to determine their destiny themselves without outside interference. Marina Kartunova, Press TV, Sochi.
My guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Omar Waqaf, who's the founder and director of Gnosos, joining us from London. We also have Richard William Murphy, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and Saudi Arabia. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both, and Omar Waqaf, if I may start with you. You have here a summit that had either close to or a little over 2,000 delegates in attendance, although maybe some of them were not on the same page. You have the Russian and Turkish president who said that they were satisfied with the outcome. They saw it as being a positive a summit. How do you see it?
I think we understand that this is a positive step forward. At the end of the day, the root cause of the problem in Syria is that two different sides in Syria, two different groups of Syrians, are pushing, you know, in different ways regarding future Syria. Some people want it this way, the other want it that way. And this is only going to be solved if those groups sit with each other and start to decide, having fought for like 7-8 years, you know, what kind of Syria there will be. This is a good step forward, probably more ceremonial than one would have expected or wished for, but at least we have a conference for national dialogue. Its predecessor, the conference that was called in July 2011 and was headed by Mr. Farouk Sharra, the then deputy president, or vice president, was not attended by opposition figures. The same opposition figures that attended yesterday were invited and did not appear and or did not accept the invitation. Now, after 7 years of war, they've accepted the invitation, so to come late is better not to show up at all, and we think this is a step in the right direction.
Well, the ones that were not in attendance, Richard Murphy, are the so-called Syrian opposition, and you also had the Kurds and their representation not there. Do you think that, A, the Syrian opposition is the true representative for them to have then decided not to show up? And then, therefore, what assessment do you have regarding the whole summit as a whole?
I think that the Sochi conference is one more chapter in the continuing international efforts to bring peace and stability to Syria. However, the fact remains that significant elements of the opposition chose not to attend, despite invitations extended, and they're not comfortable, as far as one can see, with the prospects of the continuing process organized by Russia. The United States has said that we must all agree that Geneva should be running the process. Certainly Foreign Minister Lavrov's statement was excellent in saying that those who did not choose to come to Sochi nonetheless will be included in future discussions. That's a good signal, but it has not been a persuasive signal yet.
Well, let's see here, Amar Wakaf. If we want to take a look at the stance that the United States has had, and we could also, I guess, in my question, put in Britain and France there. They have said that they wanted to stay away because of what they said was the Syrian government's refusal to properly engage. And our guest there, Richard Murphy, says that Geneva is the forum that should have these discussions. Do you agree with those assessments?
I think that's, on one hand, a misunderstanding of the real nature of the crisis in Syria, and second of all, an attempt to maintain influence. The United States and France and other parties like Saudi Arabia, for example, can see that the initiative, diplomatic initiative, is mainly now, as well as the military one, is mainly now in Russia's hand, and they fear that this, whatever they invested in this crisis to maintain influence is slipping away and it's bringing no returns. What the Geneva process means to them is, which stems, by the way, from or is related to the Security Council Resolution 2254, is that the United Nations should supervise the political solution, the political transition, and what have you. And this gives these two countries and other countries the ability to say, well, this particular political process is approved, it has legitimacy or not. So they have in their hands some sort of power should things continue to go Geneva's way. However, if two Syrians who are in disagreement with each other agree that, you know, to bury the hatchet or, you know, to lay down weapons and think of their children and their grandchildren, regardless of what was said in New York at the Security Council, it should be fair to for the United States and France and everybody else to accept whatever they agree upon. The problem we have is that there are threats from the United States, from France, from Saudi Arabia, that if you do not agree this way, and if you do not follow this particular route, which we would be happy about, you won't have reconstruction, you won't have anything, and we might as well, you could argue that this was implicit as well, we would also continue to support, for example, rebels with weaponry and whatever. So in a sense, ultimately, the process in Sochi brings down the problem to the real stakeholders, to the Syrian people, who should, at the end of the day, sit with each other and discuss whatever the future for Syria should be. What is happening in Geneva now, and it's futile, as we have seen time and again, and I've been there a few times, is that the opposition believe that they are having a peer-to-peer negotiation with the government. Now, there is a whole body of Syrians behind the government who is not recognized, and until the opposition people and those who think they are representing the entirety of the Syrian people and rebelling against a dictatorship, until they understand that there is a whole segment, actually a very large segment, of the Syrian people who do not approve of them or their ideas or their methods, that this segment is there and that they should address it and have respect of their needs and interests and fears, nothing will go on. That's why we can see all this futility at Geneva. So Sochi, in that sense, may be a step forward. It may break the ice. We've seen, again, some people who had refused for 7 or 8 years to sit in a national conference, to sit with people with whom they disagree. Now they're realizing that we need to sit with them, and they are part of the committees, and it's a very shy start. And not everybody is represented, but sure enough, if this continues in a positive mood and you know, in a constructive mode, people can build on it and others can join later on.
Well, Richard Murphy, there you have a picture of this summit that Omar Wakaf just painted for you, with the details that he provided, that gives hope for a political process to move forward. Unlike what you said, that the West in particular, perhaps countries like U.S., France, and the U.K. wants in a Geneva forum, which has failed time and again.
The situation, as I understand it, is that there's a continuing conflict of national interests between Russia, Turkey, Iran, the regime in Syria, the United States, the Saudis. There's no consensus as to how to bring this incredibly bloody warfare to an end yet. It will come. It will come one day, but it's very hard for me to see it coming outside of an adherence to the principles that the United Nations has elaborated, and an ability of the outside powers to accommodate their goals in Syria with their rivals. We're a long way from that agreement.
Omar Wakaf, you talked about Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and putting those two together. Would you say that they are the two strongest driving forces out of the different players that are preventing a solution to Syria?
Very much so, because the Qataris are not particularly there anymore because of their rivalry with Saudi Arabia and the conflict that the Gulf states have plunged into 6 months ago. They are seeking other alternatives to protect their back. They are having a rapprochement with Iran. They already have good ties, and they are investing in those ties with Turkey. And probably at some point we could see a return of the sort of anti-Saudi or counter-Saudi axis in the region, i.e. Turkey, Iran, Qatar, and later on Syria. Turkey itself has been disappointed, as we hear from the United States' insistence of playing the Kurdish card and inflating the sense of nationalism and ability to create entity or in northern and northern eastern Syria, which is a threat to Turkey's national interests, or whether The current Turkish government is insisting on perceiving it as a threat in order to maintain domestic superiority in elections and so on, is you know, debated, could be debated, but that is the case. Now Turkey sees no other route but to side up with Russia and try to salvage whatever it can from its Syrian adventure, and this is putting it, putting Turkey in liaison as well with Iran. So this whole thing is has taken some teeth out of the, let's just describe it as anti-Syrian government coalition. There remains obviously Saudi Arabia, which for all sorts of reasons does not want to concede either to Syria or to Iran in the region, and the United States, who leads a whole front from Western powers who have invested in destabilizing Syria, as they did in Libya, but are having no real gains. And what they have seen is that Russia is filling on a daily basis a huge void that they have left behind. National allies or natural allies like Turkey, like Jordan, are now visiting Moscow more than they are visiting Washington. New potential allies in the region like Iraq, for example, are very much reluctant of relying heavily on the United States. And the United States would want to counter that and prove that they are a reliable ally again. Otherwise, their interests in the region are going to be suffering a lot. So it's Saudi Arabia and the United States, as you said, as the main you know, culprits, so to speak.
Well, let's see here. If I were to ask you, Richard Murphy, given that the U.S. and any of its, I guess, what you want to call so-called rebels that they have groomed to fight against the forces of Assad, if they have lost the battle militarily, which by many counts it seems like they have, then what are they doing in Syria? What is the U.S. exactly doing in Syria?
I'm not getting the clarity, sorry. Could you repeat the question? What is who doing in Syria?
What is the United States of America doing in Syria?
It's, personally speaking, I think it's not clear what the United States is doing in Syria beyond the immediate goal of making sure that the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda do not gain in influence and gain a role in the future of Syria. That goal is very clear. The other goals, Secretary Tillerson has addressed in a talk in California within the last week, and I recommend looking at that speech that he made to define, to decide what is the United States doing. But basically, we have not committed enough force, both diplomatic and military, to achieve the goals that Secretary Tillerson spoke of last week.
Well, Omar Wolgoff, if we're going to use Secretary Tillerson as an example, tell us what kind of example does he set when he comes out, when the U.S., the Pentagon, I believe, came out and said that there's going to be a 30,000 strong force in the Syria-Iraq border, and then Tillerson makes that statement, but then the White House says, no, that's not exactly going to happen. You can't even take Tillerson for his word. And on that news of 30,000 strong force that was announced by the U.S., that obviously set off a lot of alarm bells in the region. And Richard Murphy said he's not sure what the U.S. is doing exactly. So is the U.S. there to perhaps, yes, military, to have conceded defeat, but to be there for Israel's interest perhaps, to have a watch on Syria and Iran and the region through its presence there in Syria?
Well, we believe that the United States is currently positioned in Syria in order to create a condition in northern and northern eastern Syria, whereby the Kurds would feel that they could become more autonomous. They are being heavily armed, as we understand, against the Arabs, actually, that are there. And this particular entity that the United States seems to be promoting, and we are hearing news about it every day, is probably, you know, in the minimum, would be to pressurize Damascus, i.e. the central government in Syria, to concede some, to concede on the political solution. Otherwise, the United States could continue to say, well, look, we've got this democratic paradise that we're establishing here and we're not going to leave. At the maximum, they would indeed separate that part of Syria from Damascus and say, well, look, and this is, by the way, an Israeli declared hope. And this was declared by more than 2 years ago by the former and then Minister of Defense in Israel, Moshe Yaalon. He said there needs to be a Sunni entity, so to speak, between two Shiite countries, i.e. they need a wedge between Syria and Iraq in order to cut the road between what they perceive as an axis between Tehran and southern Lebanon. Now, Tillerson, the American Secretary of State, did mention that one of the reasons why they want to be there, and actually his whole statement was about gathering as many reasons for a presence of the United States or a prolonged presence of the United States in Syria. One of them was not to allow Iran to have influence in that region, and he used the term, I think, not to allow Iran to create a northern crescent. And when we went back to search what on earth was the northern crescent, it turned out to be an Israeli expression. And this crescent between Tehran and south of Lebanon actually is north of Israel. So he's using Israeli foreign policy terminology in his own statement. And that was, you know, quite, you know, surprising. So yes, the United States, it has Israel as its main ally in the region, and it is conceivable that they are working in order to guarantee or eliminate threats that those people feel or guarantee some of their interests. But
thank you.
The United States doesn't really, as the ambassador, His Excellency, said, they're not really committing the people and resources to make it happen.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time, but it was we ended there on a good note. Thanks for that information towards the end. Amar Waqaf, founder and director of Gnosos from London, and Richard William Murthy, thank you, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and Saudi Arabia. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate from Mika Vitale and the entire team at the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.